I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, our guests on Two Jewish are Holocaust survivor Sidney Finkel and his daughter Ruth Finkel Wade, discussing his book on the experiences during the Shoah, Sevek, the Boy Who Refused to Die, and his testimony appearances at schools and public forums. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. After a week of unleavened food that ended either Monday night or Tuesday night last week, depending on whether you are Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox, and living in Israel or here in America or anywhere outside of it, in any case, Passover is now absolutely over. As we returned our home kitchen to its year-round chametz status, we discovered, as we do every year, that we had some uneaten matzah. You know, you buy the 5 pounds of boxes of matzah because it's a much better deal. You need a couple of boxes for the Seder anyway, and then you end up with 2 boxes left at the end of Pesach, just when you really don't want to see matzah again for a very long time. So what to do? How do you use up all those boxes of this unleavened bread of intestinal affliction? I have often suggested here on Two Jewish that if we burn chametz just before we begin Passover, which we do, we should therefore burn our leftover matzah after Passover. Sadly, this idea has never caught on. But instead, to play us in this morning, her now classic song, our past Two Jewish guest, Michelle Citrin, tells us 20 things you can do with matzah after Passover's over.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Catch it like a frisbee with your friends in the park, or you could jump in the water and pretend you're a shark. You can make a matzah pick and play the guitar, and you can make a matzah license plate for your car. Use it as a coaster when you're drinking your beer, or you can throw it as confetti for a happy new year.
Insulate.
Decorate.
9.
Exfoliate.
10.
Constipate.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Crumble up some matzah to line your hamster cage, or you can use it as a bookmark to hold your page. Break a stack of matzah when you practice your karate. Build a matzah doghouse for your doggy named Scotty. Make a little matzah board and wave it goodbye, or you can make a pair of matzah wings and learn how to fly. Wear some matzah jewelry, make a picture frame for me, have a drink of matzah tea. Matzah's all that I can see. There's just one more thing to do with unleavened bread. You can eat it, 'cause it ain't all that bad.
That was Michelle Citrin's 20 Things to Do with Matzah After Passover is Over. If you have other ways, let me know. Email twojewishradio18, twojewishradio18@gmail.com. I have to figure out myself what to do with those leftover boxes. So Passover is over, which means we are now in the period of the counting of the Omer, the Sfirat HaOmer, the time between Pesach, the festival of freedom, and Shavuot, the holiday of covenant, and receiving the Ten Commandments. For the 7 weeks between Pesach and Shavuos, we take a few moments every evening to say a blessing and count the days that lead us towards a reaffirmation of our Brit, our covenant with God as certified at Mount Sinai. As a passage in Proverbs teaches, teach us to number our days so that we can make every day count. The counting of the Omer reminds us that we have the capacity to make each day matter, every single day, to bring holiness into our lives daily. In the Sfirat HaOmer, the prayer that we chant every night, there is a famous traditional passage, Sheyabona Beit HaMikdash, may the temple be rebuilt speedily in our day. It's a classic text, but more than that, perhaps, it's a metaphor for what we can do in our own lives at this time of year. May we continually seek to rebuild ourselves. And if we can do that, well, then perhaps we can rebuild this very broken world. Here's the climax of Sheyabona Beis HaMikdash as sung by cantor Moshe Stern with the Israel Defense Forces Orchestra and Chorus.
Sheyabona Beis HaMikdash.
That was Sheyabona Beis HaMikdash, a classic concert piece sung by cantor Moshe Stern, a true cantorial tenor, for the period of the counting of the Omer, the agriculturally oriented time of dedication we have now entered into on the Jewish calendar. When we return here on To Jewish, our guests, Holocaust survivor Sidney Finkel and his co-author, his daughter, Ruth Finkel Wade, a second-generation survivor, will share why remembrance is so important, including at Yom HaShoah, beginning tonight and tomorrow. And he will discuss his book, Sevek, The Boy Who Wouldn't Die. All that when we come back in just a moment, right here on Too Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our special guest this morning. Sidney Finkel is a Holocaust survivor, and with his daughter, our other guest, I want to say other guest, our second guest this morning, Ruth Finkel Wade, author of his kind of autobiographical memoir, Sevek, The Boy Who Wouldn't Die. It's a really great and very accessible book. Welcome and good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So I should also note Cindy's a friend and had the privilege of having him at our Seders at our show the last couple of years, where he has spoken movingly about what freedom has meant to him. Yom HaShoah begins tonight and goes to tomorrow, Holocaust Remembrance Day, the day that we mostly observe in the United States. International Holocaust Memorial Day has become a bigger deal around the world, but here it's Yom HaShoah much more.
Especially now.
Especially now. So why especially now, Sidney? Tell us.
Because we're beginning to feel hatred against Jews. And I'm not sure that's a long thing, but we're always, I guess we as Jews are always afraid of being thrown out from our homes. And that's why we need to remember.
So your own experience is so important, and you share it. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. Tell us how the Shoah, how the Holocaust began for you.
It began in October the 1st, 1939. Germany invaded Poland very quickly. They didn't... The Polish army wasn't very well armed. It was no match for the German army. And almost immediately, we were told we have to move out of our homes. And
where was your home?
My home was in Piotrków Trybunalski, a lovely town. We had a nice Jewish group of people.
Community.
Right. People were not wealthy. Most people were poor, and they worked very hard to make a living, to have enough for Shabbat.
To make Shabbat, yeah.
It was hard to get a chicken.
And, chicken was like once a week. It was a special.
Oh yeah, it was a real specialty, there was a lot of rabbinical Rabbi Lau, who's
famous rabbi actually, who became chief rabbi in Israel later.
Yeah, and here's the thing: he had a son who was like 5 years younger than I, and we would travel together throughout the whole time. He had a brother, an older brother by about 17 years or so, and they obviously were very influential, and they were also comfortable with German
speaking. They spoke German well, yeah.
Speaking German and everything. But we were told to move out of our home quickly, like it was 24 hours. We had to leave our apartment, which was a nice 4 or 5 room, and we were put into a ghetto. The ghetto was designated by signs. It wasn't like in Warsaw where there was a wall.
Wall, right, but there were signs that limited.
There were just
signs
of the ghetto, and so we had like 2 rooms, maybe 3 rooms, for our whole family. It was my sisters, and my sister, the one that got murdered in the end, she lived in another place. She was married, and she lived in another. She had a room. We were really well off.
Right.
We had rooms. We also, the the people who helped us, my father, the most, since he was in business, he had a lot of connections with Germans, Poles that
non-Jewish that, Poles
of German
Germans,
origin.
Right, yeah.
Of German origin.
Uh-huh.
So, right away, we're not allowed to leave the ghetto.
Let's talk about what happened after that when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish with Holocaust survivor Sidney Finkel, his daughter Ruth Finkel Wade, and we'll talk about the evolution of your memoir, but also, more importantly, what happened to you. We come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and, of course, guests in our sanctuary in person Friday night and Saturday morning. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is available for the coming 5785 year for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our fantastic Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with fabulous Jewish learning. Entering our sixth year, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org and sign up. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Shabbat morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m., and services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. You can go to our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, watch our musical services, listen to them, and, of course, we'd love to have you in person. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are taught live and on Zoom. You can access those by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. And our wonderful religious school is available online, but mostly in person. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Adult Education Academy courses, Torah Tikes, and, of course, all of our services, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the most dynamic and fastest-growing Jewish congregation in southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, a kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or go to our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify, too. Post a rating, please, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. All those high compliments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470.
While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, you are just back from France, which might be your favorite country in the world, and you went to a synagogue you've been trying to go to for a very long time, and it's been there much longer than that. Tell us about it.
Right. So the region of France in which I once lived and worked is Provence, which is a large region in the south that includes several political units referred to in French as département, which is sort of looks like a county. It's the size of a large American county, but it functions very differently because it is run essentially by the Préfecture de la Police, which in turn is like an embassy of the central government in Paris. So France was always a very centralized country in which everything depended on Paris. So even though each département has elected officials and a general council and all that, the real power lies in Paris, and it exerts control through this Préfecture de la Police, which, you know, can give tickets, arrest people. They collect intelligence about people. The French gleefully spy on each other, and they keep files of, like, your food preferences, your political leanings, your religious tendencies, all that stuff they have on file.
What wine you drink, I'm sure it's all there.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a very interesting inheritance of the past. One of the special things about Provence, and particularly the department of the Vaucluse in which I lived and worked, and of which the capital was Avignon, is for hundreds of years, it was not technically part of France. It was not ruled from Paris. It was not ruled by the French king, and people weren't subject to French law. It was papal territory, so it was ruled pretty much directly by the Pope. And at one point in the 14th century, in the very early 15th century, the popes actually were in exile, and they lived in Avignon and had a summer place in Chateauneuf-du-Pape, which makes great wines.
Yeah, famous
wines. And is really essentially walking distance, if you're willing to walk an hour or so, from Avignon. But it's very different. It's a small village. It's very pretty. So there were important Jewish communities in Provence, and specifically there were five towns like there are on Long Island. It was a famous five,
the five towns.
Kedoshot.
Yeah, the five holy towns, but not exactly like Long Island.
Right, right. So one of them was Avignon, which still has a large active synagogue that is mostly populated these days by Jewish immigrants from North Africa.
And Morocco, came from Tunisia, Algeria.
Correct. But in the old days, most of these towns were settled by people who were thrown out of Spain and Portugal.
Right. Sephardic Jews who had been right. expelled.
But there were Jews there even before the expulsion.
Yeah, yeah,
there were Jews there from at least the 5th century of the Common Era, maybe earlier. But the last time I was in France, I managed to visit the synagogue in Cavaillon, which no longer functions as a synagogue. And I think
You talked about it here on Two Church. Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. So that's a beautiful museum. It's a little gem-like place. Doesn't function, but the woman who serves as a guide is very knowledgeable, and it's a very touching, sort of haunted place. There's no Jewish community anymore in Cavaillon. It's a very small town. Carpentras, on the other hand, which is not very far away, still has an active Jewish community. They have regular prayers there. They observe Shabbat and Jewish holidays as a community. And that synagogue had always been inaccessible to me on a series of successive attempts over a period of like starting in 1985 and running up to and including 2022.
So like close to 40 years you've been trying to get into this synagogue.
Right, like nearly 40 years. And this time I was traveling around Provence with the guy who was my best friend, French friend, in Paris in the late 80s. We had last seen each other in 1988.
My goodness.
He asked, is there anything special you want to do? And I said, yes, I would love to get the guided tour of the synagogue in Carpentras, which I have never been able to penetrate. He said, I'll take care of it.
Well, you'll have to tell us about the synagogue when we come back next week. Tom, thanks so much. We'll see you then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rabbi Hirsch is in his hospital bed dying. His congregants and family come close by, wanting to hear the last words of their dear leader and father. The rabbi's attendant, Yitzi, sees the rabbi is suffering from intense pain. He takes the milk from the hospital meal, goes to his car, adds half a cup of schnapps to it, and brings it back to the dying rabbi. Here, Rabbi, Yitzi says, drink this. It's good for you. The group waits to hear the prized words from their Jewish spiritual guide. Rabbi Hirsch takes a sip of the milk. His eyes open wide. He sits straighter. He drinks more. He sits up and finishes the whole cup. The ancient sage clears his throat and motions his loved ones to come closer. Yes, Rabbi, yes, what? Listen to what I have to tell you. Don't sell this cow. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well, and don't sell the cow. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the great Torah portion of Kiddushim, including the Holiness Code, a description of the ethical injunctions that are at the heart of Jewish practice. The Holiness Code itself includes mitzvot, commandments that require us to assist the poor, to treat strangers, widows, and orphans with generosity and kindness. It insists on fair business practices. It obligates us as Jews to live moral lives. It's important that this remarkable section comes in the precise center of the middle book of the Torah, Vayikra, Leviticus. Kiddushim, the Holiness Code, is in the middle of the middle of the Torah. That is, it forms the heart of the heart of our most foundational sacred text. And at the heart is the ethical injunction to love your neighbor as you love yourself. Ve'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. This is an amazing, perhaps utopian ideal. Love your neighbor as much as you love yourself. If our society were actually rooted in such a conception, how much better it would be for everyone. Can this ideal possibly be made real? Well, in true Jewish fashion, Kiddushim does not treat this as simply an idealistic statement. It's instead made a practical imperative. Kiddushim builds up to this magnificent religious commitment with a series of ethical injunctions. Leave a corner of the field for the poor and the stranger. Don't leave a stumbling block before the morally blind. Care for the widow. Care for the orphan. Be honest in business. Have equal weights and measures. Be holy because God is holy. That is, be ethical, because that lies at the heart of holiness. The way you love your neighbor is by treating him or her fairly and honestly. It is that notion of the pragmatic approach to love that is just so Jewish. We are not obligated to convert our neighbors to our own views. We are not obligated to save our neighbors from their own belief systems. We are not obligated to change our neighbors into carbon copies of us. Rather, we are commanded to treat them as we would wish to be treated, respectfully, honorably, honestly, charitably, generously. That is love of one's neighbor as expressed in a functional, healthy society, or community, or synagogue, or world. May we find a way back to that. May we be able to reach this level speedily and soon. When we come back in a moment on to Jewish Holocaust survivor Sidney Finkel and his daughter Ruth, we'll be here discussing the book Sevek, The Boy Who Refused to Die. He wrote that about his experiences and the importance of remembrance for Yom HaShoah, coming up tonight and tomorrow, Holocaust Remembrance Day. All that and more, we return in a moment on to Jewish.
We continue with our to Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The unrest on college campuses became an even greater mess this past week. At UCLA, one of my alma maters, a general riot ensued at the pro-Palestinian terrorist encampment on campus. Police removed barricades and began dismantling a fortified encampment of pro-Palestinian terrorist demonstrators last week. At UCLA, hundreds of protesters defied police orders to leave. About 24 hours after counter-protesters physically attacked the tent encampment on campus. Over 100 people were arrested at UCLA. Officers in riot gear spent hours threatening arrest over loudspeakers if people didn't disperse. Hundreds had gathered on campus, both inside a barricaded tent encampment and outside of it. As police helicopters hovered overhead, the sound of flashbangs, bright light, loud noise supposed to stun you, pierced the air. Protested chanters, "Where were you last night?" as the officers approached, talking about the attack waged by pro-Israel supporters. California Highway Patrol CHP officers wearing face shields and protective vests stood with batons protruding to separate them from demonstrators, who also wore helmets and gas masks, and chanted, "You want peace, we want justice." Police methodically ripped apart the encampment's barricade of plywood pallets, metal fences, trash dumpsters, and other things, and made an opening towards dozens of tents that the demonstrators sleep in. Police also began to pull down canopies and tents themselves. The demonstrators held umbrellas like shields when they faced off with dozens of officers. In the Mideast, Iranian state TV carried live images of the police action at UCLA, as did Qatar's pro-Arab terrorist Al Jazeera satellite network. Live images of this in L.A. also played across Israeli TV networks. The police action occurred one night after the UCLA administration and campus police waited hours to stop the counter-protesters' attack on the encampment. The delay drew condemnation from Muslim students, but also from California Governor Gavin Newsom. Demonstrators quickly rebuilt the makeshift barriers around their tents the next day, while state and campus police just watched. When counter-demonstrators attacked the pro-Palestinian terrorist encampment, they threw traffic cones, released pepper spray, and tore down barriers. Fighting continued for several hours before police stepped in. No arrests were made. At least 15 protesters suffered injuries. And the next day, a small, encampment sprang up inside the reinforced encampment. Hundreds of people, tents on the campus quad at UCLA. Some protesters said Muslim prayers when the sun set over the campus. Others chanted, "We're not leaving," passing out goggles and surgical masks. They wore helmets and keffiyehs and discussed the best ways to handle pepper spray or tear gas, as others sang. Outside the encampment, a crowd of students, alumni, and neighbors gathered on the campus steps at UCLA, joining in pro-Palestinian chants. That's Jan's steps there. A group of students holding signs and wearing T-shirts in support of Israel and Jewish people demonstrated peaceably nearby. Both crowds continued to grow as the night wore on. More and more officers poured onto campus. UCLA Chancellor Gene Block said in a statement that a group of instigators led the anti-protester attack. Well, probably the protesters, too. But he didn't provide details about the crowd or why the UCLA administration and school police did not act sooner once violence broke out. However one feels about the encampment, this attack on students, faculty, and community members was unacceptable. It has shaken our campus to its core. Block promised an administrative review of the night's events after California Governor Gavin Newsom denounced the delays responding. The head of the University of California system, Michael Drake, ordered an independent review of the university's planning, actions, and response by law enforcement. Speakers disputed the university's account that only 15 people were injured and one hospitalized, saying more people were taken to the hospital. UCLA canceled classes on Wednesday of last week. President Joe Biden addressed the protest in unscheduled remarks, saying that order must prevail on college campuses, adding that the National Guard will not intervene. Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations, none of this is peaceful protest, said Biden. Threatening people, intimidating people, instilling fear in people, that is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law. Dissent is essential to democracy, but dissent must never lead to disorder or to denying the rights of others so students can finish this semester and their college education. Tent encampments of protesters calling on universities to stop doing business with Israel or companies they say support the war in Gaza have spread across campuses nationwide in a student movement unlike any other in a long time. The ensuing police crackdowns echoed actions taken decades ago against the much larger protest movement that protested the Vietnam War, which the U.S., of course, was directly involved in. An AP count said that at least 38 times since April 18th, arrests were made at campus protests across the U.S. More than 1,600 people have been arrested at 30 schools. In rare instances, university officials and protest leaders struck agreements to restrict the disruption to campus life and commencement ceremonies. For example, at Brown University in Rhode Island, administrators agreed to consider a vote to divest from Israel in October. That is the first U.S. college to knuckle under and wimp out to such a demand. This is all playing out in an election year in the U.S., of course, raising questions about whether young voters, critical for Democrats, less so for Republicans, will back President Biden's reelection effort, given his staunch support of Israel. The nationwide campus demonstration started at Columbia University April 17th, protesting Israel's offensive in Gaza that followed Hamas terrorists launching their brutal and deadly attack on southern Israel and its civilians on October 7th. Palestinian terrorists murdered over 1,200 people, most of them civilians, raped women brutally, committed arson, tortured people, including the elderly and small children, and took roughly 250 hostages. Vowing to stamp out Hamas, Israel responded by attacking the Palestinian terrorist military network that riddled Gaza. Israel and its supporters have branded the university protests as anti-Semitic. Israel's critics say it uses those allegations to silence opposition. Although protesters have been caught on camera making many anti-Semitic remarks and violent threats, including calling for the genocide of Jews, they did that at UCLA, and for the destruction of Israel, they did that too, organizers of the protest continue to pretend that it is a peaceful movement aimed at defending Palestinian rights and protesting the war and the civilian casualties. The chaotic scenes at UCLA came just hours after New York police burst into a building occupied by anti-war protesters at Columbia University, breaking up a demonstration that had paralyzed the Ivy League school. And police in New Hampshire said they made 90 arrests and took down tents at Dartmouth College. Officers in Oregon came onto the campus of Portland State University as school officials sought to end the occupation of the library that started last week. And in Madison, Wisconsin, a scrum broke out after police with shields removed all but one tent and pushed protesters. Four officers were injured. One state trooper was hit in the head with a skateboard. Four were charged with battering law enforcement. Protest encampments elsewhere were cleared by police. They resulted in arrests and closed schools across the U.S., including the City College of New York, Fordham University, Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, and Tulane University in New Orleans. Why university populations have adopted these Gaza Palestinians, the perpetrators of horrific war crimes, including rape, arson, mass murder, torture, kidnapping, and enslavement, as their cause of the day is beyond logic. What is hip and cool in this world is not particularly closely related to reason, and it never has been. But for these supposed advocates of free speech and justice, these champions to be embracing Hamas-Palestinian terrorists is particularly insane. The Islamists they are advocating for, the Hamas-Palestinian terrorists, would, if they had the power to, shoot each and every one of these progressive supporters and likely torture and rape them first and then burn their bodies to ash, just like they did in Israel. Unless, of course, they could hold these protesters and imprison them for ransom. Of course, the enormous sums of money that Qatar, our good American ally, Iran, and other supporters of terrorism have poured into developing the pro-Palestinian terrorist networks afoot on American campuses has helped fuel the wave of anti-Semitic actions going on now. It is an ugly time. Let's see how durable these protests prove to be when colleges let out for summer vacation. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Sidney Finkel and his daughter, Ruth Finkel Wade. Sidney is the author of the memoir of the Holocaust, The Holocaust Survivor, Sevek, The Boy Who Wouldn't Die. Sidney, as we spoke earlier in the show, your family was almost immediately, as soon as the Nazis took over, pushed into a ghetto. All of you in just a couple of rooms. What happened next? What was the sequence?
Well, in spite of all the hardships and everything else, we were able to get along. We were able to get food. We had connections with German and Polish business people. And I think my dad sold his timber. I think he sold it to a German. And so we had, it was not too bad, but there was always a fear of being taken off the street and sent to a workplace, a very hard workplace. So we were never sure. But the real story here is what happens in 1942, October, I think, of 1942. Until then, there was no mass killing. There was difficulty.
Where you were, that is. There was no mass killing where you were.
Right, plenty of beating, and some of my cousins were taken out and went to work, had to go to work, had to dig things and things like that. But when the Germans had the conference and made the decision, but the decision was already made, that they were going to murder every Jew
in the world.
Yeah. And they were so happy about that.
So what happened to you? When did they shut down the ghetto? How did it work?
We were waiting for the trains to come. There's a train further south of us. So we knew that it was just a matter of a short time before the trains will be coming for us.
Did you know that they were taking people to death camps?
No. We knew that something terrible was going to happen, and we didn't want to go onto the trains.
Of course.
So everybody went for hiding places. You know, like I remember my parents, they dug up
like
floor,
under a cellar, you said.
It didn't help much because the Nazis came in with the dogs
to sniff
and
Jews,
things,
yeah.
and they went up, and then there were trains were ready for them. We didn't know that they were going to kill us. We didn't want to know because there was plenty of evidence
that was
going to happen. So I am the youngest one. My brother is 17 years older. My father is in his 50s. all line up to go onto the train. It's amazing, you know. We wanted to get up on the trains as quickly as we could to get a place, like we were going to go someplace that's going to be nice.
Yeah, like a vacation. Huh?
Yeah. Hmm. My brother talked to the German and asked him to leave us be. And he put something in his hand, probably a diamond or something.
Some amount of money.
Yeah, so he told us, go ahead, go to your workplace. The thing that they didn't mention is that out of 15,000 Jews in this community, 3,000 will be able to be allowed to leave behind.
Sidney, I mean, in all of your experiences in the Shoah, I'll ask a difficult question. Why do you think that you survived when other people, the same situation, did not? Other people were murdered, died.
It was luck.
Luck, chance.
Chance. Mostly chance.
Good fortune.
And
you were helped by the fact that your family was well-liked and well-known, and yeah, that helped you survive. Ruth, I want to ask you, you're a second-generation survivor, and I don't think people understand what it means to be a second-generation survivor. Can you just reflect on that for a moment for us as we prepare for Yom HaShoah?
Okay. As we prepare for Yom HaShoah, I think a lot about, well, especially the last many years, as my dad started telling his story, and I became more involved with what he does and
him speaking to schools, museums, talking to groups of children and
Students
and police officers and everybody. Right.
Right. So for me, it's the legacy of taking this story when he can't tell it anymore, and being able to share, you know, what the consequences are of dehumanization and intolerance, and how to, you know, what never again means in terms of, you know, any kind of genocide. So to take that legacy, this wonderful legacy and this resilience of the boy who refused to die and be able to share that with other people and do it through my own lens, because I can't know what it was like to be in his shoes. So to be able to share it through my own lens of what it was like to, you know, grow up and with a Holocaust survivor, and anybody to be able to connect with anyone who actually grows up to in the shadow of trauma, as well as educate about the Holocaust.
The fact of being a second generation survivor, not only is that responsibility, but from the second and third generation people that I've known, there's an impact on your life that I think it's difficult for others to understand. Are you okay talking about that a little bit?
Yes. And I'm very fortunate. I belong to a group, a Generations After group in Ann Arbor, Michigan for many, many years, still do. And also where I live now in Tampa, Florida. And, you know, we talk a lot about, well, how do you separate what is because you grew up with a survivor, because it's all we know, versus,
right. Yeah, yeah. How do
you know anybody
difference?
Else's.
Right.
And there's just like the survivors have, there's such a wide spectrum of experience. Some of our parents were extremely overprotective, and some of us, our parents were extremely unprotective.
Not protective. Yeah.
And so, you know, we all have had, you know, these different experiences. But I think for me, really digging into what happened to Sevek during the war and after the war, really coming to understand how much he struggled, and really helped me to understand why I didn't always feel as much love as I felt like I should get. And, you know, to survive, he numbed his emotions. And right. That's not easy to just turn back on.
Yeah, and I think that's true for almost every second and third generation person, because it doesn't just stop with a second generation sometimes.
Right. But also I see the gifts, and I see the way that my dad is resilient, refuses to die, refuses to back down from a challenge, and the way he always wants to heal. We went back to Buchenwald in 2012, I think.
Right.
And we went to the spot where he last saw his father, and he had us all put our arms around each other and, you know, talk to his father's spirit so he could heal. You know, so those kinds of lessons too are in me as well, as, sure. you know, really trying to process and understand and connect in those ways.
I want to thank both of you, Sydney and Ruth, for a great visit here on Two Jewish. And we'll have to have you back and tell more of the story, because it's an incredible story.
We're happy to be here and happy to have the opportunity.
Speaking at a school this week, we had about 200 eighth graders of all different backgrounds.
Even one Orthodox pupil.
One Orthodox student out of the 200, right?
But we had afterwards, they were all so engaged and so courteous and attentive, asked so many wonderful questions. And afterwards, they all wanted to have their picture taken with Dad. And, you know, one little guy was so sweet. And, you know, he was Muslim, you know, his name was, you know. And, I mean, just you feel like you're doing something really important when your story gets shared with, you know, all these different people who, you know, you can make an impact where he makes an impact. Dad has been speaking for many, many years now.
Yes.
He had a wonderful relationship with a teacher in Cabot, Arkansas, of all places.
Huh.
Okay. And he spoke there for many years, and they made him a garden. And this was one of the first places where he just felt overwhelmingly loved. And we got a letter, an email just this week from a history teacher in North Carolina who was a student who saw him speak in Cabot, Arkansas, and said that that made an impact on him and his life and his career choice.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. When we come back on Two Jewish, we will hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Join us next week on Two Jewish. Our guests will be Elizabeth Barry White and Joanna Sliwa, discussing their extraordinary nonfiction biography, The Counterfeit Countess, about a Jewish woman who pretended to be a Polish countess and saved many Poles during the Holocaust. And please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha each Friday night. Services at Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, Kiddush, in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning also comes from Michelle Citrin. We had 20 things to do with matzah after Passover's over. This is her update version. 20 more things to do with matzah after Pesach. Eesh. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov. Don't forget Yom HaShoah. Our community commemoration is at 2 p.m. here in Tucson. It starts tonight and goes through tomorrow, Holocaust Remembrance Day. Have a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat?
You can make some matzah cards and play with your friends, or you could wear a matzah costume for Burning Man. You could make a cover for your iPad or your iPhone. Stuff it in a pillow, it's better than foam. If your table is uneven, you can make a matzah shim. Or you could play a matzah football game and flag it to win.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.